I don't think, if you look on the origin to the two things, that I think they are rather parallel, because I don't think there was much a change from one to another. Kennedy had, in his last half year, directed his economic advisers and all the rest to look into this poverty program. Here you had a sort of what I call intellectual and moral catharsis. Americans were always accustomed to live with this enclaves of misery and poverty in their midst. You know, here they had to face it. And there were books written, every university of some reputation wanted to have a conference on poverty, you know. We had statistical investigations, all of that. And when, 2 days after John Kennedy's death, when it was reported to the vice president, who in these cases, in many other cases, were not very well informed, kept informed of what was happening, so it was very necessary that he got this briefing. And then they told him about these poverty things which were going on. And both, I think, because I would not deny that, because he was a poor Texan boy himself, you know, had heart for the poor, you know, and I suppose also a politician who smelled votes in poverty, this was a big thing, this should be carried on. And the speech makers and phrase makers in Washington found these tremendously challenging words, the war against poverty. There is an adjective there. The unconditional war against poverty. And a little later, they found this great society. What was not done, because I think it's important that we keep in mind that other movement, which is related to the Negro issue, as so much of what the poverty has to complain about is they are kept down in poverty, a large mass of the Negro people. Then they started the poverty program. And the poverty program, we can look back on it now, we can say what I said from the beginning, that it's under-dimensional, I mean, compared with this challenging pathetic phrases of the unconditional war against poverty and great society. It was spurious, it was not planned, and it was not well administered. To me, I mean, this is a sort of, but of course, people in my position, I suppose most of us, nevertheless were hopeful that it could grow to something bigger. And we can analyze why it didn't. There are many, many causes, but I do believe that the Vietnam War again played a very damaging role, both because it monopolized interests in the people, took away interest from other issues, and particularly from the rulers in Washington, and because it took away money at disposal for the big reforms at home. There, of course, the President Johnson and even McNamara could come out so late as not more than a year ago about, and say that we can do both. We can both, this is such an immensely rich country, we can do both, we can have the war, and we can do the reform. But this is not just simply true. This is true theoretically for an economist, but then you would have to change all the priorities and change many things. Sure, America is rich enough to do both things, but this is not how an ordinary citizen or a congressman looks upon it. So there, I think we have one of the main reasons why you had this retreat, so to speak, in the poverty issue. From an economist point of view, of course, the main thing to be said is that there was no planning. It is possible that if Kennedy had lived, he was more of an intellectual, of course. That in spite of all the political difficulties it would have been to create it, he would have gone into planning. And if he had started to plan, then of course, to make a plan, but if I should give any criticism of the Wright Commission, which otherwise is right in line with American tradition, in line with my books, whatever good people want, it is that they do not see this, that the poverty program is not only the bigger problem, but is the main problem. Negroes are of the poor, many more Negroes proportionally are poor than outside, than if you take the rest of the population. Nevertheless, the poor Negroes are only a quarter or a third of the really miserable, really slum people in America. And there you have the Puerto Ricans, the Mexicans, many of them. You have Asians, you have some of the new immigrants who are still not disappeared into the dominant America. You have, and then you have the old Americans all over the country, not only the, up in the mountains. The poor whites. I remember I came once to Bloomingdale, a beautiful little university, you know, put right on the country. The professors live in dollhouses, and I said, have you no poor people here? Oh, you can, I will show you the Kentuckians. They said, took me to slums, Kentuckians, living in shacks, you know, prostitution, alcohol, and drugs, and unemployment, of course. These are not new immigrants. You know, these are old Americans, and you have them all over the place. You have all the rural slums. You have an excellent report about a year ago on the poor in the rural areas. American agriculture has been tremendous, but the majority of the people, as you know, live in big poverty. This is a very, very important element which is tending to disappear because all this publicity about the Negro problem. I mean, that the poverty problem is the main thing and is a much bigger problem. Well, it's technically connected, because I think you should realize that it's not really, if you don't want to have an African apartheid situation, you can't plan rationally housing for Negroes. You must plan a change of housing for all poor people. You can't have an educational policy where you improve schools for Negroes. You must improve schools for all the poor people. You can certainly not overcome discrimination in employment if you don't have a general full employment situation, because otherwise you will never succeed. So in this way, I mean, the Negro problem is a little piece only of the much bigger class problem. There is another reason why you can't just solve the Negro problem as a special thing, and that is, of course, that in my time, you know, radical people at that time, they had a crude Marxian ideology that poor people, you know, whites and Negroes, etc., are the same people, that's an economic problem, and they keep together. It's a natural thing for them to keep together. Of course, the true thing is, which our radicals today have learned, that the real enemies of the Negroes are the white people, are poor whites everywhere, and in the lower middle class. I mean, by the housing discrimination, the contamination goes quite high up, because they don't want to have their houses in lower value, even if they could have some abstract idea that there should be justice. Well, now, a plan, I'm not going into it, but I know enough about the general dimensions of an American economy and the social stratification in America, just simply to say that if you should make a plan, what it will cost, to get a decent America, where you solve these social problems, as we have solved them in more advanced welfare states, it will cost you $1 trillion. I've said it, or perhaps more, it will have to be in terms of $1 trillion. These petty ideas that you can solve it just by what you call it, minimum wage, what is minimum income, I mean, guaranteed income of some sort, which will not cost more than $12 million. Is it so, a year? Well, my friends, they will leave the slums as they are, they'll leave the schools as they are, and you will just have it. I mean, it involves, incidentally, reforming your whole taxation district system. As long as it's possible to move out to a suburb where there are cheap taxes and good schools, you know, this is impossible thing. Take St. Louis, which I happen to see here, which is more extreme part. The man who is responsible for schools there, he was just weeping and said, what can I do? I'm labored day and night. But it's just my poor people. Outside you have the suburb. It's the whole transport system, which Huntington, who is coming here, you can ask him about, because he made a special system. A study of that, which you'll have to change. These are tremendous big changes. And this, there will have to be parks, and there will have to be, you know, everything different. And then you have the human inside, which must be reformed, which can be reformed. The present situation is this. You know, you cannot assume that I'm particularly an enemy of the Indians and Pakistanis, even if they don't want me to say it. But the present situation is, if you take India and Pakistan, where you have 700 million people, if you make surely I don't wish it, but if you make the thought experiments that they would sink in the ocean tomorrow, it would not make the slightest change in our business curves in the rich world. There is so little we need from them, you know, and they need everything from us. You've got a similar situation in your slums by letting poverty go on in this way. The real trouble is, of course, that so many of them in this technological age are not employable, then in the sense that there is not enough demand for it. If the Lord went around and just erased the slums, America would not be poor. Translate that now to more human terms, and then you would say this, that America is actually operating with a huge debt to its poor. Huge debt to its poor. And this you should take into consideration when you talk about yourself as so immensely rich. Of course, it's a funny thing about these Americans, you know, I can say it as I'm so much involved with you, that there is a certain insecurity. You have a committee reporting on the budget, and you must start by saying that the United States has the best budget in the world, which is, of course, a lie to begin with. It's just mistaken. I've been studying budget once in my life. I was in it this year. And why is it necessary? Why doesn't the committee say this is the type of structure of American budget? We should, for this and these reasons, change that. But why should they have this? Why should you always remind you that you are the richest country in the world and so on? Which is doubtful, my friends, if you calculate a debt to your poor, which you must pay if you're not going to see this society blown up. This is my main point, which is very important. I think I will finish. I'm stressing this thing that this is really what need to be said very much. Reston has said it, and there are other people who have said it. But it's not conscious. This is another escape of the ordinary American that he believes. He can be very sad for the blown up, the Negro problem, etc. Who problem, how can we address it? And this is an escape because he escapes the bigger problem, which is three times as big or four times as big, and that's the poverty problem, which is not a Negro problem. And even my friends among the Negroes need to be reminded that they are not unique at all. I mean, they are just a minority, not only of the whole nation, but also of the misery-stricken, poor slum dwellers whose life has to be improved. I said that it was a mistake among my radical friends at that time to believe that there was a natural solidarity. Another reason, it is not. And one of the other reasons why I have not been able to stand for, you know, this idea of Young, that there should be a Marshall Plan for the Negroes. Another reason is, if there is anything which is going to make the Negro have a hell of a time, it is if you make special advantages, give special measures for the Negro. That will not be very popular just among the broad masses of Americans in the working class, lower classes, among the poor, and high up in the middle class. This is the political reasons. From a policy point of view, however, we must carry out is to get the Americans to agree to do something for all the poor. And this is a big, big problem, and we can discuss it. This is, after all, a seminar. I do not believe personally many, you know, this nationalistic movement, there's always been nationalistic, you had the Garvey movement and so on. This one is tougher, and reasons behind it are some of those which I've pointed out. And they feel, of course, very often tempted to be so much of defeatists that they go in for separation. And there you should remember a thing, when the Supreme Court, made this decision, which is by far not carried out in many parts of America. It's more segregation now than at the Supreme Court. They quoted me in saying that separate cannot be equal. Remember, my friend, separate cannot be equal. Just by being separate, you are going to... The only possibility of equality is not to be separate. And let me tell you here a story, and then I will end, and we can have a discussion. At that time, from the 20s on, you know, the Communist Party had the program to have a separate Negro state. It was stressed more or less prominently. When I had to inquire why there were so few communists among the Negroes, this is not because they were particularly conservatively inclined or something like that. It was just because they didn't want to have a separate state. But who wanted a separate state, incidentally? I remember at that time, many of the really, when I was traveling in the South, you know, really reactionary Negro baiters in the South. Really reactionaries, you know. I remember one, I was sitting with two of them, and the one said, you know, these commies have a point, you know, they have a point. If we can close them up here in some counties, you know, and get rid of them, this would be grand. And perhaps we'll have to throw over some food so I'm not going to starve too rapidly. You know, this is, the commies have a point. The commies have a point. And then the other said, but you know, we want them to work for us. We must organize some sort of door so they can get out under safe control and then return again to their separateness. I think this is a story which has a lesson for us. It might be rather easy to convince, unfortunately, I say, so many reactionary Americans, because there are so many reactionary Americans, to convince them that this separateness, you know, this is a grand idea. This is a grand idea. And we get rid of them. We'll just close them up. Well, I will stop there, and I hope we'll have a discussion now. We have some time, haven't we? Yeah. Well, this was an attempt, I mean, without... Or when they said a seminar, I thought it was 15 people around the table and not a big hall like this.
The talk this afternoon has to be a seminar. When Dr. Myrdal agreed to be David Kinley lecturer this year, it was with the understanding that he would give a public lecture in the seminar. And since the public lecture was given last night, why, we have no choice. This must be the seminar. Are there questions?
Sure.
College tuition is going up across the whole nation.
Yeah.
Would you, and in this university, they're proposing to raise it to something like $320 for undergraduates, which is doubling, or approximate doubling. Would you comment on the economic effects of this?
Yeah.
How it relates to what you said?
You know, I think this is. I mean, if you want my personal, you know, I'm a squarehead, so I'm just answering you. Whatever the administration says, I think this is very wrong in America. America was very early, earlier than we, democratizing its higher education to an extent. They did it, as you know, very much because you could work yourself through, which was not possible at our universities. Partly because our strong trade unions would not allow, now it's easier, now they can work because we have full employment for such a long time that the trade unions are not protectionist any longer. But nevertheless, I've seen this, how it's creeping up. And this is, of course, very, very dangerous because it's less possible now than in my youth when I was here. In my youth, 60% of the Harvard students, which is a rich university, earned their way through, partly at least. And it's less and less possible. And that will, of course, mean making it very, first, the difficult if you are, and even if you are an upper middle class person, you have three kids, to pay this tuition. You know, I think it's a very, very dangerous trend. Of course, when I look on it from my point of view, we have had the absolute opposite development. Tuition has always been absolutely free in our country since long time, even when it was a very aristocratic thing with for very petty upper class people going through it. It was free tuition. And now we have carried it so far that students, whatever income their parents have, this is in order to make youth independent, whatever income their parents have, they have rights to cheap credits and to stipends, which makes it possible for any youngster not to be hindered from university education for financial reasons. And I do believe that that should be the goal also of America. I mean, if you want to make the country democratic, isn't that right? So this is my opinion. You ask me and I answer you.
Without national economic planning, in other words, what are the implications for the economic structure along the spectrum from free enterprise to national planning?
I don't believe that that has anything very much to do with the national structure. We are supposed to be a socialist state, as Eisenhower said. The ruling party since 36 years, and we have now, and the whole world is going direction. We are the biggest victory in the world, 90% participation of the electors, and we are there. And we have, of course, much less socialism than you. Depends what you mean by socialism. But if you mean state enterprise, we have no state. We have very little, and there are always a particular reason for it. You have more state on the tank, I'm quite sure, more people employed by the government than we have. But we have made big reforms, and we control business. You know, you have a banking inspector. Oh, you have that too. You have more regimentation here because administration is not so. It's much more regimented country than Sweden. So I don't see what that should do to the structure. You would need national planning, for Lord's sake, and I suppose you have national planning. You know, surely you should plan your policies. If that is what I mean by national planning, you should coordinate. You should make changes, and changes would be coordinated in such a way that the cost would be a minimum and the advantage the maximum. The planning I'm talking about is really not the structure of industry. Surely you would find, probably, that you would like to have another ownership for houses if you are going to change the whole, rebuild the cities. But not necessarily. It should be a plan where do we have the people, what incomes they have, how do they live, how are the schools, etc., etc., and then make the changes. You see, on schools, for instance, my heart is a little split, because on the one hand, it's very nice that the neighbors rule the schools. On the other hand, for Lord's sake, in a progressive country, you must have minimum standards for schools. And you haven't had minimum standards for schools. And you have permitted, sometimes the schools, as you know, in southern Illinois here, have been very under the level. I mean, it's not only the Negro schools which are bad, and the rural schools. I mean, minimum standards. I mean, this is what's natural to carry out. That is the type of planning I mean that you clear. And what shall we do is transport. I mean, if you want to rebuild, how you are going to make the parks now? You have all these planning architects, but you know they are never really permitted to do the bigger plan. You see what I mean? I don't see you don't need to become what you call a communist country, regimented and all of that, in order to have big social reforms. Surely you would have to have higher taxes. You know, my friend down here asked me about tuition. Surely if you take upon the state to see to it that youngsters have a free entrance and can go through schools, if they're good, to the top, surely you will have it on your tax bill. I mean, you will have to have higher taxes and have tax reforms, which you need anyhow to get them more just.
When you talk about higher taxes,
yes, and then you would have to clean your political process. The plan is a tremendous. Sure. This is collective consumption. But look here now. Surely, only to clean the slum-mindedness, to make, I mean, the youth which are growing up in the ghettos having the same real opportunities, which means the same real qualities in various districts, will be expensive. I, as an economist, think I can tell you that this is an investment in human resources, which in time will be profitable. But for a long time, sacrifices are necessary. The right control, the right commission, who nevertheless did not go into the big poverty problem, as I critically remarked, nevertheless they stressed this, that sacrifices are necessary for a long period. If you want to it's not only talk, these are realities. If you want to change society, it will cost money, surely. You will have to abstain from something. You might abstain from trying to go to the moon, which I think is incidentally, you should be big enough not to need to go to the moon in order to demonstrate how big you are. If then these poor Russians need that in order to have some prestige, let them have it, for Lord's sake, to go to the moon. Why should you put billions into this supersonic plane without asking first whether the people want to have it? When I go to New York, I mean, this is an easy thing. It takes me 7 hours. I read on the plane, have dinner when I come to New York with my friends. Why should I want to go in 3 hours instead of 7? We are going to forbid it. We have already announced it. We are going to forbid these supersonic planes over our country because it's dangerous for hygienic reasons, for our ears and things like that. Why should you spend money on that? I mean, these absolutely wrong priorities, which is as an outsider, and then all the money you spend on wars and war preparations, which of course we do not know. That's the reason why, of course, we are richer than you, in spite of the fact that you have, according to bad statistics, a third bigger national income per head. It's just a quarter. But that quarter is spent in ways which are really not of use for communities. And the cost, of course, of a less well-organized society, the cost, indirect cost of all these slums, police and fire protection, all these illnesses and all of that. It's that type of plan. Now, it's very common among us intellectuals, you know, to put the blame, this I want to stress whenever I talk about these things, to put the blame on Congress, these reactionary senators, you know, reactionary Congress. I have in long life come to know your congressmen. They are very ordinary Americans. They are, and I repeat it, they are, of all parliaments I've been able to study, the one who is most sensitive for public opinion in the world. Our parliament is not so sensitive for movements in the public opinion as your Congress. So these wrong priorities I'm talking about, they are the wrong priorities among the people, among the voters in America. And that is incidentally what our academic community should think a little more about, how you could educate the American public not to have such absolutely wrong priorities of leaving the slums as they are while flying to the moon for billions. You know, I mean, this is another thing which is also becoming obvious, and another reason why the Negro problem in America is not looked upon with the same sympathy as earlier. We see you are spending money, I mean, in ways which we don't agree with, while you do not do enough for the poor in your country. You know, I started with this international perspective.
Yes, if I may pose a question also on the international level. In comparison of race problems between countries, I believe in the northern parts of Sweden and in northern parts of Norway and Finland, there are large numbers of blacks living up there.
Oh, my friend, yes.
And I was curious what the Swedish government and the other Scandinavian countries have done to integrate the blacks into their society. And what the position of the lapse was in the
Well, you know, you might say that in periods of our history, we just forgot about the lapse. They are not so goddamn many, go by the rings. But then, between these periods, we are doing a lot. We have all sorts of schools, and schools where they can live, which is a more expensive type of schools, and of course they can come to our universities, and we try to protect their reindeer marks and try to keep it open so they can wander between the countries and so on. It's not a major problem. Much more of a major problem is the immigration problem. You realize a country like Sweden now, we have more foreign-born inhabitants than you ever had during the worst migration period before the First World War. We have relatively more. And this is a big problem. You might ask what we are doing about that. And fortunately, our trade union system, which is 100%, not 25% as you have it, although it's much younger, they are all for equal rights, you know, never discrimination, I mean, all for it. Our local communities the same, all organizations, youth organizations, all of that, and the government. And we are trying to do our best. Nevertheless, there are problems. If you are, if now we have your defectors, your deserters which come over us as a curse, you know. You have honored us. We have only 230. Of course, there are thousands and thousands in Canada and France and everywhere. But you have just picked on Sweden, most newspapers, as the hostile country. They have come over us. We have not particularly invited them. Most of them are very ordinary people, high school graduates from small towns, you know. And you don't need to be very bright in order to find it good to get away from the army in Vietnam, you know. I mean, some are better. I mean, what we have done, we have declined calling them political refugees because we didn't want to perhaps hurt them by that. You see what I mean? We have an agreement with America that we shall not, that military offense is outside, what do you call it, the rules for sending back criminals, you know that. And we've let them be there, and as they are not political refugees, we call, say that we do that for humanitarian reasons, which sometimes has made the American more mad than ever. But now, they are there, you know. It's a lot of trouble. Many of them become narcotics. I hope this doesn't come in the newspaper because I don't want to hurt them. And or sell that, you know, it's difficult. Only the very, very best try to adjust themselves. We open schools for them. We have, of course, not the legislation for that. They have to go into our ordinary system, and of course, our ordinary system is not made for that type of people. Many of them are anxious and don't go into work, but some of them are adjusting very well, and we have.